Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 129, but who's counting? It's Monday, August 30th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, we've cracked 100,000 hospitalizations for COVID-19. This is the highest since January. And the scary part is deaths are now increasing faster than cases. It is catching up with us. Well, let's get right to it with some COVID-19 news. This headline sums it up pretty well. Here's your decision. Get vaccinated first or be infected first? This from The Hill. From the onset of the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic, there has been hope that, quote, herd immunity will eventually protect those who forego vaccination. Herd immunity is a concept that when enough people have acquired immunity to the virus, virus transmission will be reduced to negligible levels. You might be among the herd of hopefuls banking on having made it this far already, bolstered perhaps by the knowledge that none of your friends or family has gotten seriously ill with COVID-19. If this is your strategy, I'm sorry to tell you that science and history show that this won't work. I have studied immune recognition of respiratory viruses and how viruses avoid immunity for 40 years. There are two things that I can relate with complete confidence. First, SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 is not going away anytime soon, if ever. COVID-19 is similar in many ways to the devastating 1918 pandemic, which was caused by the introduction of a new influenza, that is flu virus, into the human population. The 1918 flu virus and its mutant descendants, variants, think Delta variant, infected nearly everyone in the world over the next few years. It is still morphing into new variants 103 years later as it continues to circulate around the world. Herd immunity has slowed transmission, but everyone has been infected and reinfected multiple times with the descendant of the 1918 flu. And reinfections are not limited to flu. Other coronaviruses and many other human respiratory viruses can reinfect you multiple times. Second, when it's your turn to be infected with SARS-CoV-2, your body will be in a far better position to defend itself if vaccination has educated your immune system to fight SARS-CoV-2. At this point, approximately 99% of COVID-19 deaths occur in the unvaccinated. In other words, full vaccination reduces your chance of dying from COVID-19 by nearly 100-fold. Fortunately, the COVID-19 vaccines are among the most effective vaccines ever developed and are far more effective than influenza vaccines. However, they are not perfect, particularly in the face of variants like the Delta variant, which can evade some of the immune response. Nevertheless, while vaccinated people might be infected, they are far, far less likely to become symptomatic or hospitalized than non-vaccinated people. While the COVID-19 vaccines do have side effects, serious reactions are exceedingly rare. Vaccination is, in fact, far safer than infection, at least 1,000 times safer. Vaccination not only protects you, but those around you, since even if you are infected, you will be less infectious to others, including millions in the U.S. alone who cannot effectively vaccinate due to health issues and age. Importantly, every day you wait to be vaccinated, your chances increase of getting a serious, even lethal case of COVID-19 or long COVID, since age is the major risk factor for these outcomes. Your decision comes down to this: be vaccinated first or infected first. It's that simple, given the certainty that SARS-CoV-2 will eventually infect you. It might be easy to dismiss my advice as yet another opinion by a random, quote, expert, But why risk getting COVID-19? Why risk being the next headline patient pleading for vaccination as they are being intubated? Why risk being eulogized? COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths, even from the Delta variant, are almost entirely prevented by vaccination. Prepare your body for battle and get vaccinated today. Okay, next up from Medical Express. Delta variant doubles risk of COVID-19 hospitalization compared to Alpha variant, new UK study confirms. People infected with the SARS-CoV-2 Delta variant have approximately double the risk of hospitalization compared to those infected with the Alpha variant, the original form of the virus. A study of more than 40,000 cases from England between March 29th and May 23rd of this year, published in the Lancet Infectious Disease Journal, has confirmed. This new study is the first to report hospitalization risk for the Delta virus versus Alpha variants based on cases confirmed by whole genome sequencing, which is the most accurate way to determine the virus variant. So again, the bad news here is that there was uncertainty before. There was some belief that the Delta variant was more deadly, meaning that the case rate fatality was worse, but this has confirmed that it's actually on the higher end. It's not 25%, it's not 45%, it's double the chance of dying from the Delta variant versus the previous variants. Or should I say the original Alpha variant. So is it any surprise that we're seeing way more cases and deaths than we saw last summer? Even though we have about half of our population vaccinated, those that are unvaccinated are more than making up the difference for those that are getting vaccinated. Of course, much younger people are being infected, so the overall deaths are less. But the relative rate, the relative risk of somebody who's unvaccinated, you're more likely to get it. And if you get it, you're way more likely to die from it. And next up from CNBC, we'll get at the difference between hospitalization between vaccinated and unvaccinated. CDC study shows unvaccinated people are 29 times more likely to be hospitalized with COVID. Unvaccinated people are about 29 times more likely to be hospitalized with COVID-19 than those who are fully vaccinated, according to a CDC study released last Tuesday. The new study also found that unvaccinated people were nearly 5 times more likely to be infected with COVID than vaccinated people. Okay, this next article from Stat News gets at the difference between the actual disease and then the chance of getting infected. And there's a lot of confusion when they talk about efficacy. Generally, when they talk about vaccine efficacy, they talk about prevention from serious disease or death. But let's do it here from Stat News. COVID-19 vaccines flirted with perfection at first. Reality is more complicated. When COVID-19 vaccines were reported last fall to be roughly 95% effective at preventing symptomatic COVID-19 infections, the world rejoiced, and even veteran scientists were blown away. Very few vaccines are that protective. Those made to fend off viruses like SARS-CoV-2, viruses invade the nose and throat like flu, typically aren't at the high end of the efficacy scale. That was good news. Now, however, our soaring expectations for COVID-19 vaccines are in the process of sinking back to earth. With more transmissible Delta variant of SARS-2 circulating, it's increasingly apparent that even if mRNA vaccines like Pfizer's and Moderna's offer impressive protection against severe COVID infections, they aren't going to prevent infections in the upper respiratory tract of some proportion of vaccinated people. The vaccines are wondrous weapons, but they aren't impenetrable armor. We all wish that this would go away, that we would get a vaccine and we would control it, Catherine Edwards, a vaccines expert at Vanderbilt University, told Stat. But I think that looking back, probably that wasn't always realistic. There are still open questions about exactly how much less protection mRNA vaccines may be providing. Evidence of the downward creep of their efficacy is based in part on an as-yet-unpublished data from Israel, one of the first countries to vaccinate a high percentage of its elderly. For Michael Osterholm, the jury is still out on what is behind the increase in cases among vaccinated people and how big a threat it poses. It all comes down to, is it waning immunity against severe illness, hospitalizations, and deaths, or is it waning against mild disease? And I don't think we've answered that yet, said Osterholm, who is director of the University of Minnesota Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Now, I think it's the right question to pose. The challenge is we just don't have the answer to that yet. A critic of the booster decision, Anna Durbin, believes the high bar set by the results of the Phase 3 clinical trials of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines is now negatively impacting U.S. vaccination policy. "I think these vaccines are a victim of their own success," says Durbin, a vaccine researcher at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. "Now we expect perfection, and if it's less than perfect, we want a booster." Some scientists have noted that a year ago, when the Phase 3 trials for these vaccines were first underway, the world would have been ecstatic at the prospect of vaccines that prevented severe COVID infections in most vaccinated people. But vaccine efficacy estimates in the 90% range against even mild infections reset what we thought these vaccines would be able to do for us. Vincent Munster, chief of the virus ecology section of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Rocky Mountain Laboratories in Montana, also thinks our expectations may be unrealistic. "We were making a vaccine against a severe COVID, and all of a sudden, all these expectations of transmission blocking were piling up on these vaccines," he said. Case in point, in announcing the decision to offer third shots, CDC Director Lewinsky cited a study from New York State that showed the mRNA vaccine's efficacy against any infection had declined to 80%. But the same study showed protection against serious illness was still above 90%. For many experts, it was evidence not of a problem, but of success. Munster, Durbin, and many other experts insist that the vaccines are still standing up as well as they can in the face of a daunting challenge. With vaccination rates in a number of states still far too low, the amount of SARS-CoV-2 circulating is dismayingly high at this point. More than a year and a half into the pandemic in the United States, the way to make progress in the fight is to get more people vaccinated, both here and abroad, to cut transmission and the risk of new variants emerging, they insist. Giving a booster to vaccinated people is not going to control Delta. What's going to control Delta is vaccinating unvaccinated people, Durbin said. That is the bottom line. Okay, well, I haven't spent much time reporting on a point-by-point counterpoint to every doubt that somebody has about the vaccines. Partly that's because most of them aren't actually scientifically based, and actually repeating the errors in thinking actually confuses people, because when you hear falsehoods, you tend to remember the falsehood rather than remembering the truth that it's a falsehood. Yeah, there's some psychology for you. But this is a landmark study on a vaccine safety from Medical Express. Here we go. "Largest real-world study of COVID-19 vaccine safety published. Previous efforts to characterize vaccine safety have relied on voluntary active reporting by vaccinated individuals, which is known to be incomplete. The present study relies on the analysis of millions of anonymized electronic medical records, which are far more comprehensive. Furthermore, in order to provide the necessary context for interpreting vaccine safety findings, the study is the first to examine a wide range of adverse events, both among vaccinated individuals and among unvaccinated individuals who were infected with the coronavirus. Thus, two separate analyses were conducted. First, vaccine outcome analysis. Almost 900,000 vaccinated individuals aged 16 and over were carefully matched with a similar number of unvaccinated individuals based on an extensive set of sociodemographic, geographic, and health-related attributes. Individuals were assigned to each group dynamically based on their changing vaccination status. Almost 250,000 individuals moved from the unvaccinated cohort into the vaccinated cohort during the study. Rates of the 25 potential adverse events within 3 weeks following either vaccine dose were compared between the two groups. In the second analysis was on infection outcomes. To provide context for the vaccine safety findings above, a separate analysis was conducted that estimated the rates of the same 25 potential adverse events among 173,000 unvaccinated individuals who were infected with the coronavirus, compared to the same number of carefully matched controls who were not infected with the coronavirus. And what did we find out? The vaccines are very safe, particularly compared to an infection. For the vaccines, myocarditis was found to be associated with the vaccine, but rarely, 2.7 excess cases per 100,000 vaccinated individuals. In contrast, coronavirus infection in unvaccinated individuals was associated with 11 excess cases of myocarditis per 100,000 infected individuals. Okay, now this gets at with a complication in reporting rare side effects. Because if I just say, oh, if you get the vaccine, you have an excess of 2.7 cases per 100,000 of myocarditis, and people are like, oh my God, that's really crazy. But the thing is, if you don't get vaccinated and you get infected, then you have 11 excess cases of myocarditis per 100,000. Now, you notice that's about four times the amount. So in other words, if you have a 1 in 4 chance of getting infected if you're unvaccinated, which is actually less than the actual experience in the U.S. Another study that just showed recently basically a third of the U.S. population has been infected at this point, actually through the end of last year, even more since then. So given the real-world experience, if you want to avoid myocarditis, take the vaccine. It's more dangerous to be unvaccinated and chance of getting the coronavirus infection, which is much more risky. Okay, other adverse events moderately associated with vaccine were swelling of the lymph nodes, a mild side effect that is part of a standard immune response to vaccinations, with 78 excess cases per 100,000. Appendicitis with 5 excess cases per 100,000, potentially as a result of swelling of lymph nodes around the appendix, and herpes zosters with 16 excess cases per 100,000. Okay, so take those two, you know, 5 cases and 16 cases per 100,000, so 21 cases per 100,000, and then compare this to what you see in the same survey of those 25 adverse events with those that were infected. In contrast to the relatively small number of adverse effects associated with the vaccine, high rates of multiple serious adverse events were associated with coronavirus infection among unvaccinated patients, including cardiac arrhythmias, almost fourfold increase, with 166 excess cases. Kidney damage, about a 15-fold increase, the 125 excess cases per 100,000. And remember, comparing this to the two other things that were 20 cases per 100,000 in excess. Pericarditis, a 5.4-fold increase, 11 cases per 100,000 excess. Pulmonary embolism, 12-fold increase, 62 excess cases per 100,000. Deep vein thrombosis, 3.8-fold increase, 43 excess cases per 100,000. Myocardial infarction, a heart attack, 4.5-fold increase, 25 excess cases per 100,000. And stroke, a 2-fold increase, 14 excess cases per 100,000. Obviously, it is profoundly more dangerous to go unvaccinated and even risk a relatively small probability, if that were the case, of getting infected, which is actually not the real-world experience, than it is to get vaccinated. This is what, of course, most experts have been preaching all along, but now we have even more solid data showing this huge difference. And it's important to note that this study was studying the real-world impact before the Delta variant became dominant. As I just reported, it's more infectious and it's more deadly. So we'd expect these nefarious results to be even worse with infections that are happening today versus 6 months or a year ago. Okay, well, next up, a story related, if you're curious about, those vaccine skeptics. This from Medical Express and the University of Oregon. Disagreeable people found to be more prone to conspiracy theories. People who are antagonistic, exploitive, and generally disagreeable are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories, according to a recent study from the University of Oregon researcher. Cameron Kay, a doctoral candidate in the Department of Psychology, found that people who possess personality traits known as the Dark Tetrad are more likely to believe Princess Diana's death was orchestrated by the British royal family, that the moon landing was faked, and that alien spacecraft are being stored at Area 51, among other conspiracy theories. Kay's study was published in the Journal of Personality and Individual Differences. The traits of the Dark Tetrad are Machiavellianism, which is manipulativeness and cynicism, narcissism, which is vanity and self-obsession, psychopathy, impulsivity and callousness, and sadism, cruelty and abusiveness. Most people have elements of some of these traits, Kay said. In plain terms, it seems like disagreeable people who score high in these traits are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. They are prone to odd beliefs. They don't feel like they are in control of their lives. They are robbed of their agency and have an innate distrust of other people and organizations like the government. In analyzing the results, Kay found evidence that aspects of all four of the Dark Tetrad traits are associated with conspiracist ideation. Nearly all of the associations were attributable to the tendency of those with disagreeable personalities to hold odd beliefs, be fatalistic, and distrust others. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, folks, well, regardless of what you believe about the vaccines, so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions, which are things like masking and social distancing, are actually very important layers of the protection in our battle against COVID-19. So this from Medical Express. Simple familiar tactics can rein in the COVID variant. Steep declines in Delta variant outbreaks in India and more recently the UK are likely not due to the nation's reaching, quote, herd immunity or viral behavior, but rather because of shifts in human behavior prompted by mounting cases and deaths, Harvard experts say. William Hanage, associate professor of epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health, dismissed speculations that the declines were due to a combination of Delta infections, vaccinations, and prior infections that pushed the UK past the herd immunity threshold, at which a sufficient number of people developed resistance to infection, stifling transmission rates. When you see huge morbidity and mortality, people change their behavior, Hanage said. You need to mandate those non-pharmaceutical interventions in order to prevent the really, really bad outcomes, because people generally don't do them until really bad outcomes are already baked in. You could see that in India, when people started doing that, adopting non-pharmaceutical interventions, the Delta started to come down quite quickly. Hanage said the declines in India and the UK should be viewed as good news in the US, as it means that despite its greater infectivity and ability to cause breakthrough infections in those already vaccinated, Delta, like other variants, is susceptible to widely available non-pharmaceutical interventions. In the UK, Hanage said there were two major drivers of the surge. One was reopened schools with few pandemic precautions. That meant that when Delta arrived, there was a large unvaccinated population of school children vulnerable to infection. The second factor, he said, was a major soccer tournament, the Euro Cup, which not only filled stadiums, but also brought people out to pubs and house parties to watch matches. When schools went on summer vacation and the tournament ended, levels subsided. Hanage said another example, that of the Netherlands, reinforces the idea that the variant is susceptible to the kinds of non-pharmaceutical interventions that appear to have been effective against different strains. The Netherlands opened up widely and then suffered a rapid spike in Delta cases. The government immediately imposed what Hanage described as moderate targeted controls, like closing nightclubs and curbing late hours for restaurants. The other interventions in the Netherlands were relatively small, and Delta cases just collapsed really quickly, Hanage said. We have to be careful about ascribing causation, but I think that with the combination of the UK and India, it shows how vulnerable Delta is to changes in human contact networks. The lesson for the US, Hanage says, is that we shouldn't be fatalistic about Delta's arrival and spread. Despite its increased contagiousness, which has led to soaring cases in states, we still can be in control of the pandemic, but we have to be willing to take the necessary steps. Fatalism is not going to help, especially when the natural history of the outbreaks in places as diverse as India and Scotland, England, Netherlands, illustrate that there are things we can do, Hanage said. Since the Alpha variant became widespread in early 2021, The idea that the pandemic would end by limiting COVID-19 has faded. Instead, the most likely outcome is one in which virtually everyone has been vaccinated, infected, or both, and consequently severe COVID-19 cases would become relatively rare and within the capacity of the healthcare system to handle. Delta makes that a virtual certainty, Hinoj said. I said at one point that the quickest route towards not wearing a mask is getting a shot. That was before Delta, unfortunately. Now you need both. And another non-pharmaceutical intervention that hasn't been talked about much at all lately. This from Medical Express. Contact tracing takes a backseat during latest COVID surge. Health investigators across the U.S. are finding it nearly impossible to keep up with the deluge of COVID-19 infections and carry out contact tracing efforts that were once seen as a pillar of the nation's pandemic response. States are hiring new staff and seeking out volunteers to bolster the ranks of contact tracers that have been overwhelmed by surging coronavirus cases. Some states trimmed their contact tracing teams this spring and summer when virus numbers were dropping and are now scrambling to train new investigators. Others have triaged their teams to focus on the most vulnerable, such as cases involving schools or children too young to be vaccinated. Texas got out of the business entirely, with the new two-year budget that takes effect September 1st explicitly prohibiting funds being used for contact tracing. Oh my God. That left it up to local health officials, but they can't keep up at a time when Texas is averaging more than 16,000 new cases a day. The work is relentless, and the calls, which can last an hour, can be emotional. Workers making contact tracing calls not only help people learn about what they should do to keep themselves and others safe, but they can hear from the people who are scared, lonely, or grieving, or in need of assistance, such as with paying rent or getting food. Staff try to help and connect people with other resources. It's hard to do this day in and day out calling perfect strangers. People are not as eager to talk or do interviews as they were earlier in the pandemic, when there was a lot more fear and unknowns about the virus. Now I think people are a little tired of COVID. I think we all are, frankly. Well, hear, hear. Unfortunately, the virus doesn't care whether you're tired or not. And of course, kids, who are often the most vulnerable, are caught in this mix. This from NPR. A vaccine for children is not likely to be improved until the end of the year. Parents and caregivers may have to wait until the end of 2021 before a COVID-19 vaccine is fully approved for young children ages 5 to 11. The news comes from Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, in an interview with NPR's Morning Edition. Collins said both Pfizer and Moderna are still collecting trial data, trying to understand, among other things, whether young children should receive a smaller vaccine dose than that has already been approved for adults. Pfizer could submit its data to the FDA for review by the end of September, Collins said. But he added, I've got to be honest, I don't see the approval for kids 5 to 11 coming much before the end of 2021. While full FDA approval is likely several months away, Pfizer's vaccine could be cleared for emergency use earlier, possibly in October, after the submission of the trial data. The NIH director also weighed in on the heated fight in states requiring children to wear masks in schools. Collins says he's puzzled by the debate, saying there is ample evidence that wearing masks will help prevent COVID-19 outbreaks. Ultimately, Collins said, masking will help keep schools open. If you want to avoid having that outbreak that's going to send all the kids home again, you should be doing everything to avoid that, and that means wearing masks. And by the way, if somebody tries to tell you we don't really have scientific evidence to say that masks reduce infection in schools, that's just not true. There are dozens of publications, both from the U.S. and other countries, to show that's the case. So boy, I wish we could get over that fight. It's a fight, Collins said, that is getting in the way of what is going to be a tough enough fall as it is. And in a related story from Medical Express, students' lack of routine vaccines muddy start of school. The vaccinations that U.S. school children are required to get to hold terrible diseases like polio, measles, tetanus, and whooping cough in check are way behind schedule this year, threatening further complications to a school year already marred by COVID-19. The lag was caused by pandemic-related disruptions last year to get to routine doctor's visits, summer and sports camps at which kids usually get their immunizations. Now, pediatricians and educators are scrambling to ensure that backlogs don't keep kids from school or leave them vulnerable to contagious diseases. It's a big deal, said Richard Long, executive director of the Learning First Alliance, a partnership of education organizations that has mounted a public outreach campaign. We are going to have kids getting seriously sick this fall, and the sad part is, for the most part, it's preventable. Despite administered doses again approaching pre-pandemic levels this fall, they did not increase to the level that would have been necessary to catch up children who did not receive routine vaccinations on time. A full reckoning for schools is still weeks off, when grace periods that allow unvaccinated children to temporarily attend school begin to lapse around the country. But the COVID-19 surge linked to the Delta variant has added new hurdles, including swamped doctor's offices and clinics, and even potential shortages of medicine vials, syringes, and needles, to the swirl of confusion and fatigue already facing those working to tackle the backlog, health and pharmaceutical experts said. Okay, well, it's time for the local COVID-19 update. But I would like to give just a little bit of context for that. In the U.S. right now, 98% of counties are at a high transmission level, as defined by the CDC. That means less than 1 out of 1,000 Americans live in a county with low transmission. 2/3 of counties have a test positivity rate of over 10, which is not very good. Under 5 is the goal. Okay, well, back to Lucas County. The 7-day average daily cases jumped up by 39% from 92 a day on average to 131 and most recently. This is a rate of 203 per 100,000 per week, which is 4 times higher than what Governor DeWine was saying that he was going to, when he was going to get rid at 50 per 100,000, the mask mandate and such. Now we're 4 times higher than that, and the governor is silent as far as reimposing mask mandates. So when will that happen? I don't want to wait too long. Okay, well, the testing positivity rate in Lucas County is 11.3%, and the testing numbers are up over 20%. So it's really gearing up. We're seeing way more testing, to over 20% more, and we're seeing the positivity rate go up. Obviously, that's what happens when you got a raging pandemic. Now, the Ohio test positivity rate is 10.9, although I must admit, I've been trying to sort out this data, and I cannot really find good comparable data for Lucas County and the state of Ohio. This sort of speaks to the state of public health, no pun intended, our state of public health, is that it's all fragmented. So I get more recent test positivity rate data from the CDC is what I'm using for the county. But the state reports it for the state level, but they don't produce it at the county level. What they produce at the county is a positivity rate for nursing homes, which is helpful, but it doesn't tell you the population, you know, the entire testing that's happening in the entire community. Either way, both well over 10% and going the wrong direction. Okay, well, nursing homes are back up with some cases. It moved up from 17 active cases to 15. That's 9 residents and 8 staff. So being pummeled, of course, we're going to get some cases in nursing homes. And historically, this has been the most hard-hit community in the U.S. Okay, hospitalizations are rising steadily in both Lucas County and Ohio. And the new hospital admissions in Lucas County were up about 50% in the last week. Nationally, deaths have gone over 1,100 a day, and this is steadily rising. And the scary thing is this is much faster than cases, so it is catching up. I have that image, you know, of a train coming down the track. And here we are thinking, oh, that seems pretty far away, big old train. You know, standing right in the middle of the track, looking at it, doesn't seem that dangerous until it smacks you down and that slow, apparently slow-moving train hits you. Doesn't have to hit you very fast, to hit you pretty hard. That's my image of the rising death rates. Now, the question again is, how high will it go? Well, with that recent study from the UK that I reported on that said that you've got to double the chance of hospitalization from the Delta variant, even though it's hitting younger people, it's still throwing people into the hospital. Okay, well, for vaccines, we're talking about fully vaccinated rather than partially vaccinated, the U.S. is over half of the population at 52.3%, up 0.8% over the last week. Ohio is still under half of the population fully vaccinated at 47.9%, and Lucas County is even a little bit lower at 47%. And Ohio and Lucas County are still not vaccinating additional people as fast as the U.S., so we are actually falling further behind as a state. Okay, well, you are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM. This is Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's get to some non-COVID news for a change. This from Medical Express, and it's a little bit better news. Little change in number of uninsured in pandemic's first year. While the COVID-19 pandemic has had a big impact on the economy and jobs, it didn't result in fewer Americans having health insurance. The number of 18 to 64-year-olds in the United States without health insurance held steady at 11% between March 2019 and April 2021, according to a survey by the Urban Institute, a social policy research organization. Unlike the last recession, losses in employer-sponsored insurance during the pandemic did not lead to growth in the number of the uninsured, said Michael Cartman, a senior research associate at the Institute. Medicaid and the health insurance marketplace has provided many people with a safety net that allowed them to maintain coverage during difficult times. The Affordable Care Act helps states to expand access to Medicaid, as well as establish these marketplaces to provide affordable health coverage to more people. What did change was how people were insured. The number reporting public health insurance coverage rose almost 8 million from 13.6% to 17.5%, or an absolute number of 3.9% of people being added to publicly funded health insurance. Meanwhile, about 5.5 million fewer adults were covered by employer-sponsored health insurance, a drop from 65% of that age group, 18 to 64-year-olds, to 62.3%, an absolute drop of 2.7%. The analysis also found the percentage of adults who had public coverage in states that expanded Medicaid rose from nearly 15% to 19.2%. That's a 4.2% absolute rise. In states that did not expand Medicaid, that grew less, from 10.7% to 14.3%, or a 3.6% absolute rise. The uninsured rate in April 2021 in non-expansion states was 18.2%, more than double the rate in Medicaid expansion states. More than 1 in 3 low-income adults in non-expansion states were uninsured in 2021, compared with about 1 in 7 in expansion states. Those who suffered the most from the economic fallout associated with COVID were low-wage workers, so the loss of job-related coverage was less than in previous recessions. The enhanced safety net provided by the Affordable Care Act was critical in keeping people covered, especially in states that expanded Medicaid. Well, what do you know? The free market can't solve every problem.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure health care for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, the next couple articles I want to cover help answer the question, are our nonprofit hospitals really doing a good job to produce community health? First up, from The Hill, are nonprofit hospitals holding up their end of the tax-free bargain? Tax exemptions are estimated to save nonprofit hospitals over $24 billion each year. In return, the hospitals are expected to invest these would-be tax dollars into caring for underserved populations, charity care, and improving the health of their communities. In order to maintain their nonprofit status, Congress requires hospitals to rigorously examine communities with a formal community health needs assessment and document how they are addressing those needs with an implementation strategy. Rather than making these responsibilities central to their mission, our recent work suggests many hospitals are simply checking the community health needs assessment box on their IRS forms and mailing them in. This is unfortunate because we need hospitals now more than ever. The events of the past year have illuminated two major deficits in the American healthcare system: insufficient progress towards health equity and chronic underinvestment in public health. The lack of public health infrastructure, for example, siloed agencies, data collection, and exchange challenges, undertrained workforces, stems from a substantial decrease in federal support over the past 40 years. In many towns and cities, the local hospital serves as the most important public health resource. During the COVID pandemic, hospitals not only cared for the sickest patients, but also filled gaps in public health infrastructure by leading COVID testing and vaccination efforts. We recently reviewed 500 nonprofit hospitals to see if they were holding up their end of the bargain. We found that 1 in 6, 16%, didn't have public available community health needs assessments, and 25% didn't even have an implementation strategy. Of the available needs assessments, 25% of the hospitals aren't posting resources available to invest in community health, and over 40% aren't describing how they are evaluating their community health improvement efforts. Among the hospitals that reported implementation strategies, fewer than half are rated as high quality. Given the billions of dollars in tax breaks that hospitals receive, this substandard transparency calls into question how diligently nonprofit hospitals are partnering with and striving to improve their community's health and well-being. Federal policymakers must act to ensure that taxpayers are getting a reasonable return on their investment. Here's what they can do to implement stronger standards for hospital transparency and accountability. First, health equity should be central to hospitals' community needs assessment and implementation strategy processes. The IRS should require hospitals to report how their investments have improved community health, particularly for marginalized groups, and account for how their actions impacted health disparities in the area. Next, to promote transparency, policymakers should establish an online community health needs assessment rating system. Medicare has star ratings for things like hospital readmission, patient experience, and safety. Restaurants have cleanliness ratings from local departments of health. Why not adopt a similar system which incorporates input from community stakeholders and holds hospitals accountable for addressing their health needs? Finally, to achieve greater hospital accountability, the federal government should develop a community health investment standard that ensures hospitals' tax benefits are justified. Policymakers can learn from the Loan Institute's Hospital Index. The Public Available Index provides an analysis of over 3,000 hospitals nationwide and compares their tax benefits against their community benefit spending. Using such a system, the government could determine which hospitals are paying their fair share in community health investments and base tax incentives and penalties accordingly. To be sure, during a public health emergency, a hospital's focus should be providing life-saving treatment, not navigating through administrative burdens. And of course, running a hospital is challenging and many are financially strained. In fact, over 130 have closed in the past decade in rural areas alone. Yet at the same time, many nonprofit hospitals are quite stable financially, benefiting from years of consolidation and enhanced negotiating power, with generous CEO salaries and hefty growth in assets. If hospitals expect to maintain their tax-exempt status, it's time they start delivering on their communities, on their commitments to the public. And in a related story, this from Stat News, in a new hospital ranking, doing good counts nearly as much as doing well. You won't find the usual suspects like Massachusetts General Hospital or the Mayo Clinic at the top of a new ranking of U.S. hospitals. That's because the rating system relies not just on traditional quality measures, but also on a hospital's community-minded practices and avoidance of unnecessary care. The rankings show that these hospitals with good clinical outcomes tend to score poorly in addressing inequities that affect the health of their communities. And even when hospitals perform many low-value procedures, those that research has shown to be of limited or no benefit, their patients generally have a low risk of dying both in the hospital and after being discharged, as well as a lower risk of having to be readmitted. No previous hospital rankings use civic leadership, which includes community-minded policies such as charity care, financial aid, and paying all staffers a living wage, or value of care, meaning whether a hospital avoids 13 procedures of questionable or clearly absent clinical benefit. The Loan Institute, LOWN, A nonprofit think tank in Brookline, Massachusetts, incorporated both measures into its rankings of 3,282 hospitals because it is time for hospitals to rethink what it means to be great, said Lone's president physician, Vika Sahani. Civic leadership matters because the health of people in a hospital's community reflects things outside the four walls of a hospital, he said. If one patient is going back to a community without a lot of resources, where health equity is low, and another is going back to a wealthier community, their long-term health will be very different, even if the quality of the care in the hospital was identical. Hospitals have an obligation to improve the health of the outside community. Veterans of hospital rankings generally applauded Lone's efforts, with caveats. I love that they're measuring civic leadership, said Sarah Singh of Stanford University School of Medicine, an expert in healthcare management. I also think they're right to evaluate overuse of low-value procedures. You want to be sure you aren't going to receive treatments you shouldn't be receiving. She questioned, however, whether those measures should be bundled into a composite score. Quality of care indicators such as staffing levels and patient outcomes such as surgical mistakes and bed sores account for 50% of a hospital's composite ranking and associated letter grade, while civic leadership counts for 30% and value of care 20%. I'm not sure civic leadership should influence where a patient chooses to get care as much as a quality measure should, Singer said, though I can see using it to decide where you might make a charitable contribution. In contrast, patients should do well to consider a hospital's overuse of procedures that research has shown to have little clinical benefit, she said, such as knee arthroscopy, spinal fusions, EEG for headache, hysterectomies for benign conditions such as uterine fibroids or pelvic organ prolapse, and putting stents in renal arteries. Although a patient having, say, a hip replaced might not care whether a hospital performs many vertebroplasties, that's injecting bone cement into vertebrae to treat osteoporosis, or other low-value procedures unrelated to planned surgery, Singer said, I can imagine that if a hospital is over-treating patients with these particular procedures, it might over-medicate, over-sedate, or over-treat you for what you're there for, too. In addition, some low-value care disproportionately affects people of color. Black women are more likely to have unnecessary hysterectomies than white women are. Many hospitals perform high numbers of low-quality procedures, which tend to be lucrative, and waste an estimated $100 billion per year in healthcare spending. The right thing to do financially isn't necessarily the right thing to do for patients, said Leah Binder, president and CEO of the Leapfrog Group, a nonprofit backed by large employers that aims to identify and promote high-quality, high-value healthcare and whose hospital ratings emphasize patient safety. She called Lone's decisions to downgrade a hospital performing many low-quality procedures a breakthrough in hospital ratings. We know inappropriate care is an extremely significant problem for the healthcare system. It's also a terrible tragedy for individual patients who go through an unnecessary procedure. Of the top 100 in the Lone ranking, 91 are nonprofits. Only 9 are safety net hospitals, even though they account for 21% of the total. That's probably because these hospitals tend to serve poorer communities. And even if they provide excellent care, patients might not receive the high-quality follow-up care that can keep them alive and healthy. Quality of care includes the percentage of patients who die in 1 month, 3 months, and 1 year after their hospital stay. Life expectancy, said Sayani, often depends more on your zip code than your genetic code, an argument for hospitals to contribute to community groups that make a zip code healthier. The top 100 also include 53 teaching hospitals, which make up only one-third of all hospitals. Their overrepresentation reflects generally excellent patient outcomes and a culture of avoiding procedures that lack scientific evidence of efficacy. The starkest disparities between many hospitals' excellent patient outcomes and their poor civic leadership as measured by Lone. It used Internal Revenue Service and other government data for CEO pay and spending on charity care and community organizations. The leaders for civic leadership were Harris Health System in Houston and 5 New York City public hospitals. On average, 2.8% of hospital expenses went to charity care. But while the most charitable spent 15% or more, about 150 spent less than 0.1%. And although some nonprofit hospitals whose tax-exempt status requires them to provide, quote, community benefits, spent 20% or more on their community, some spent less than 1%. A number of hospitals renowned for their quality of care got A-plus or A for patient outcomes, but a D for civic leadership, including Massachusetts General Hospital, the Cleveland Clinic, the Mayo Clinic, and the University of Washington in Seattle. Teaching hospitals such as these do pretty well in supporting your communities, but pay equity, multi-billion dollar salaries for top executives, sinks them in Lone's calculations for civic leadership. Not a single hospital in the top 100 for patient outcomes was in the top 100 for civic leadership, and vice versa. Few patients are likely to reject a hospital based on how much of it pays for CEO, for its CEO relative to its custodians. But Binder called civic leadership an important metric. If there's anything you want out of a hospital, it's ethics, she said. Charity care, community support, and pay equity are informative about a hospital's culture. Okay, well, if you want to compare your local hospitals, you can do them side by side. You just have to search online for Lowen Institute Hospital Index. That's Lowen, L-O-W-N, Institute Hospital Index. But I've already done some of that for you, so I'm comparing side by side on a sampling of these from the Toledo Hospital, University of Toledo Medical Center, and Mercy Health System, St. Vincent Medical Center. Okay, well, statewide, out of 123 hospitals, Toledo Hospital was ranked 9th. Very good overall. UT Medical Center, 85th out of 123rd. And Mercy St. Vincent, 105 out of 123. Not so great. Okay, well, let's take a sampling of some of the measures. Under civic leadership, this kind of new measure that we're talking about, pay equity. And this is in the percentile of hospitals in the U.S. Pay equity for Toledo Hospital ranks in the 18th percentile. A little better, UT Medical Center, the 76th percentile, and coming in last of the three compared at 14%, the 14th percentile, is St. V's. Okay, community benefit. Do a little bit better here. Toledo Hospital at 73rd percentile. UT Medical Center at the 58th percentile. And St. Vincent's comes in first on this one at the 84th percentile of the three compared. Okay, and the value of care, that's avoiding overuse in this case. Ranking in the 46th percentile is Toledo Hospital. UTMC ranked in the 30th percentile. And wow, really badly, St. V's ranked only in the 7th percentile as far as avoiding overuse. So apparently St. V's is doing a really crummy job of not giving you procedures that don't really provide any benefit. And of course, usually have some kind of side effect and obviously costs. Okay, well, let's look at a good overall measure is what do people in the community, specifically the patients that go to these institutions, what is their patient satisfaction? And on each of these cases, it's not good news for the Toledo healthcare system. For Toledo Hospital, 29th percentile. For UT Medical Center, 7th percentile. For St. V's, 26th percentile. Yikes. Apparently, whatever they're doing, the patients are not particularly happy. And that's compared to all of you as healthcare, which in general, people are not too thrilled about.
And now, for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, let's drill down a little bit to dealing with one racial bias and inequity in healthcare. How to overcome racial bias in wait times from Medical Express. Research studies show that black patients can be subjected to wait times 30% longer than other patients at doctor offices and other healthcare facilities, leaving little doubt about the biased nature of healthcare scheduling systems. New research in the journal Manufacturing and Service Operations Management has identified factors that contribute to this racial disparity and found ways to create parity among all patients. The study is called Overbooked and Overlooked: Machine Learning and Racial Bias in Medical Appointment Scheduling. This solution has been dubbed race-aware and accounts for the fact that the racial group with the highest chance of not showing up is typically scheduled in undesirable slots and therefore wait longer. We found that if clinics decrease the wait time of the racial group expected to wait longer, they nearly eradicate the unintended racial disparity and do so without negatively affecting the clinic efficiency. Some reaction to this method may be that patients who typically show will be penalized. It's a rare win-win-win situation. Currently, these scheduling systems are penalizing Black patients for not showing up based on socioeconomic issues that are out of their control. Disparities are present across many areas and cause a ripple effect for underrepresented groups. For example, due to transportation issues, Black patients cannot always reach their appointments, meaning they get scheduled in overbooked slots and wait longer. Another example of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Treat people equally, and people will be treated equally. Okay, well, I want to close today's reporting on some better news. This from Science Daily. Think leisure is a waste? That may not bode well for your mental health. Feeling like leisure is wasteful and unproductive may lead to less happiness and higher levels of stress and depression, new research suggests. In a series of studies, researchers examined the effects of a common belief in modern society that productivity is the ultimate goal and time's a wasting if you're just having fun. Spoiler alert, having fun is good for your health. People who most strongly agreed with this belief that time's a wasting if you're just having fun not only enjoyed leisure less, but also reported poorer mental health outcomes, said Celine Malcock, co-author of the study and associate professor of marketing at Ohio State University College of Business. There's plenty of research to suggest that leisure has mental health benefits and that it can make us more productive and less stressed. But we find that if people start to believe that leisure is wasteful, they may end up being more depressed and more stressed. That was true whether the leisure activity was active, such as exercising, or passive, such as watching TV, or social, such as hanging out with friends, or solitary, such as meditating. In addition, the more they thought leisure was wasteful, the lower their levels of happiness and the higher their levels of depression, anxiety, and stress. The negative view of leisure is not just an American issue. One study which compared people in the United States, India, and France found that the French were less likely than those in the U.S. and India to believe leisure was wasteful, as is consistent with cultural stereotypes. But for those in France who did disdain leisure, the bad effects were the same. We live in a global society and there are people everywhere that hear the same messages about how important it is to be busy and productive. And once you believe that and internalize the message that leisure is a waste, our results suggest you're going to be more depressed and less happy no matter where you live. The researchers were struck at how the negative views of leisure affected enjoyment of anything fun, no matter the situation or how short the leisure activity was. For those who believe leisure is wasteful, it may be helpful to think about the productive ways that individual leisure activities can serve their long-term goals. In other words, connect each leisure activity to something you want to accomplish, she said. Find ways to make fun activities part of a larger goal in your life. Think about how it is productive, instrumental, and useful. But of course, while you're doing that, get rid of the notion that productivity is the center of health. Relaxation plays a critical role. So just relax, folks. Okay, we're going to close the show with some bonus articles that you can read online, and I'll give you the link at the end. There's four today. COVID vaccine shows no sign of harming fertility or sexual function. In contrast, the novel coronavirus can disrupt both things in unvaccinated men and women. Two, Biden falls short on pledge for the U.S. to be the world's vaccine arsenal, experts say. Three, pandemic unveils growing suicide crisis for communities of color. And fourth, lastly but not leastly, humanitarians push to vaccinate in conflict zones. A good example of how public health needs to push to the most vulnerable areas in order to be successful. A great read. I recommend it highly. You can read these articles and the other articles I covered in today's episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.